From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Arthur Penn, the film director Pauline Kael described as having a gift for violence. His movies include Bonnie and Clyde, The Miracle Worker, Night Moves, and the new film Penn and Teller Get Killed. Also today, John Jurassic tells us about writing the authorized biography of his godfather, the late Jean-Paul Sartre. Jazz pianist and composer Kenny Barron plays a tribute to the late Thelonious Monk, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg takes a look at a new version of the old grammar book, The Elements of Style. The new version is on video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Federal drug agents and local police seized 20 tons of cocaine today at a warehouse in Los Angeles. Three men were arrested. About $10 million in cash was seized. The men in custody were not immediately identified, but were believed to be South American. Today's seizure is the biggest drug haul in history. President Bush toured storm-ravaged South Carolina today and defended his administration's handling of the cleanup in the wake of Hurricane Hugo. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details.
South Carolina officials say the federal bureaucracy is slowing down the cleanup. They say there are not enough disaster claims offices and not enough people at the five offices that have been open so far. After touring areas hit in South Carolina, the president said he is satisfied that the federal government has moved expeditiously.
To the critics, I simply say I understand. We are trying very hard, and there are men and women, the U.S. services, of FEMA, out there giving of themselves just as their as the people's neighbors are here.
Today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president will increase the number of federal disaster claims offices from 5 to 9. I'm Phyllis Crockett reporting.
The three-year residency of the Nicaraguan Contras in Miami is coming to an end. The Bush administration has cut off their funding with the explanation that the rebel political activity should be taking place in Central America. Rick Stone reports.
The size of the rebel profile in Miami had always reflected the Contras' standing in Congress. At its height, when Contra military operations against the Sandinista government were fully funded, Miami was at the center of the Contras' political, financial, and logistical networks. Guns, money, and medicine were transshipped to the rebels through here, and the Contra leadership maintained several offices and a bureaucracy of 60 clerks and functionaries. The presence was scaled back when military funds were cut off last year, and now, says Contra leader Adolfo Calero, it will end.
This is a typical end of an alliance with the United States.
The lingering Contra presence will be a small office staffed by volunteers who will monitor next year's election in Nicaragua. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
A Beverly Hills jury today found former East Bloc beauty queen Zsa Zsa Gabor guilty of slapping a policeman, driving with an invalid license, and having an open container of alcohol in her car. She was acquitted of the charge of disobeying a police officer. The charges stem from Gabor's encounter with Officer Paul Kramer. The charges carry a maximum penalty of 18 months in prison and a $3,400 fine. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over 2 points to close at 2692.82, but advances led declines 3-2. This is NPR News. A congressional committee today worked out a compromise legislation in an effort to end the bitter dispute over government funding of the arts. The House-Senate panel watered down a sweeping amendment to an Interior Department bill that had shaken the art world and raised fears it would stifle creativity and infringe on freedom of expression. The amendment had been proposed by Republican Senator Jesse Helms after two art exhibitions, paid for partly with money by government-supported National Endowment for the Arts, had aroused wide controversy. A new study comparing a health system in Canada with one in the U.S. shows more Canadians receive coverage than their American counterparts for the same per capita cost. Carol Levinson has more on the study released by the Washington State Medical Society.
The three-year study looked at the health care systems in Washington State and in the nearby Canadian province of British Columbia. The researchers determined the quality of care was about the same in both areas. The per capita costs were also nearly equal. The difference, however, according to Dr. Robert Aldrich, is the system in British Columbia covers 100% of its residents, while the Washington state coverage reaches only 85% of its citizens. Aldrich says the 15% not insured in Washington state equals about 600,000 people. If those people were covered, Aldrich contends, the per capita cost would be much greater in Washington than in British Columbia. Unlike Washington and other states, the British Columbian government provides health insurance for its citizens from prepaid health care premiums and taxes. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
Democrats said today President Bush's proposed cut in capital gains taxes is in for a fight in the Senate. Senate Finance Committee member Bill Bradley said he thinks the deficit reduction plan to be written by the panel next week will not include the capital gains cut, which the House approved yesterday. Instead of that cut, Bradley said the committee is likely to approve a measure making taxable deductions to individual retirement accounts. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The concluding death scene of Bonnie and Clyde influenced how a generation of filmmakers choreographed violence on the screen. My guest Arthur Penn directed Bonnie and Clyde and 12 other films, including The Left-Handed Gun, The Miracle Worker, Mickey One, Alice's Restaurant, Little Big Man, Night Moves, and The Missouri Breaks. His new film is the comedy Penn and Teller Get Killed. It was written by and stars Penn Jillette and Teller, the magic and comedy team known for their macabre sense of humor. The movie is set in motion when Penn tells a TV interviewer that life would be more exciting if someone were trying to kill him. And soon there are several attempts on his life, but we're never sure which are his partner's practical jokes and which are for real. This plot leads to violence, but it's a comic violence and requires a different kind of tone from Arthur Penn's earlier films.
Well, the tone is essentially intended to be comic. It's not really, in that respect, quite a violent film. It's nothing like what goes by on the average movie screen at this point in life. It's a rather sweet-natured, I think, film. And it's playing, of course, with a game of illusion and reality. They're magicians, in fact, and comic magicians, and they do a lovely act in the theater and had such a nice run on Broadway and previous to that off-Broadway. And their humor is kind of personally confrontational and really rather sweet, extraordinarily sweet, actually. And it was that sort of duality that we chose to try to maintain in the film.
The guns in the movie have a different kind of pop than I'm used to in movie guns.
Yeah, well, we muted all that sort of thing. Because it's not a movie about Charles Bronson. It's just the reverse of that. As a matter of fact, there's a moment in there where Teller has the opportunity to fire a gun and instead fires his finger.
I thought that was an homage to Taxi Driver, another Taxi Driver homage.
Well, it was in a way. It was in a way.
I have to say that there is a scene where there should be blood and isn't any.
Yeah. Well, since we play with blood in so many of the sort of comedy scenes, you know, because they are stage magicians and they use stage blood very, very openly, when it does get down to the real thing, I thought it would be wise not to do what so many people have been doing, including myself, perhaps, in previous occasions, which is saturate the screen with red dye number 4 or something.
Is that what you use?
I don't know. They make it up. You know, each prop man has his own magical formula.
Mm-hmm. No, we're talking about your use of violence in this comedy. I want to go back to 1967 when you made Bonnie and Clyde, which was really a landmark film in part because of how you handled the violence in it, particularly the scene at the end where Bonnie and Clyde each take dozens of bullets and their bodies twitch with the impact long after they're dead. This film led Pauline Kael to say, Penn has a gift for violence. Despite all the violence in movies, a gift for violence is rare. Did you think of yourself that way, as having that gift?
No, I wouldn't have defined it that way, but I guess you have to understand that we were operating, of course, in a totally different social context in those days. It was in the midst of the Vietnamese War, and daily news, the news of that we saw on television, had body counts and numbers of soldiers wounded and dead. And it was a time where it seemed to me that if we were going to depict violence, that we would be obliged, really, to depict it accurately with the kind of terrible, frightening volume that that one sees when one genuinely is confronted by violence. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did in Bonnie and Clyde. Also, we were doing it at the same time with a kind of, at the end of the film, with an attempt to raise these two characters to a kind of faintly mythic proportion. So it was done in an extraordinarily complicated technical way, but the end result was to sort of propel them upward into myth, and that was the attempt, at least. And to some degree, I think we succeeded. We also succeeded in upsetting an awful lot of people.
Yeah. Can I ask you how you choreographed and shot that last sequence where Bonnie and Clyde are murdered with dozens of bullets?
Yes, but I'm afraid it'll be hopelessly technically difficult. But let me try and give you a short volume answer, okay?
Oh, please, yeah.
All right. One of the things that I attempted to do was to have it in different speeds. And the way you achieve slow motion in film is by actually running the film faster so that many more frames are exposed. And that's what produces slow motion. So the intention there was to get this kind of spastic motion of genuine violence at the same time the attenuation of time that one experiences when you see something like a terrible automobile accident or, in my case, certain occurrences in the war. It was this extraordinary stretch of time while these events were taking place. And so what I did was I ganged four cameras together, all running at different speeds, some at very, very, very high speed, and some at just double normal speed, some at four times normal speed. It was to get this kind of spastic, balletic violence. That was really the attempt, to really join time and space. And that's how we did it, in layman's terms, without getting into the technical aspects of it too deeply.
Now, I was just running back that scene last night on my VCR, and I think the part where you really see the slowed-down action is just when Warren Beatty takes the first bullet and falls to the ground.
You were aware of it there, but it runs all the way through the scene. So it's all done in different time motions,
mm-hmm.
all the way through to the very end of the scene, including Faye falling in the car and her hands slowly bouncing, and then stopping.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was done by these four cameras in different speeds.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the sound of the bullet sounds like it's real time.
Exactly. We kept that, we decided to do it, I decided to do it, at a visual expansion of time and an auditory continuum of time in normal, apparently normal extension of time.
What, for disorientation?
No, actually, for orientation. I thought if we disoriented the sound as well as we disoriented the film, that we would then be clearly engaged in the movie aspect of it. And I didn't want you particularly to be aware of the medium at that point. I was hoping that you would be caught totally by the nature of the action on the screen.
Was there a code in existence at the time that you made Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, yes.
What did the code say about violence, and did you have any problem getting the film through? Because for its time, it was extreme.
No, may I try to correct a couple of things?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Yeah, first of all, it was not extreme. What it was that it became a cause célèbre because the critic at that time of the New York Times had decided to engage in a campaign against what he perceived as violence in films. And he was really objecting to many other kinds of films. When this came along, however, it provided him with the perfect launching pad for a real diatribe against our film and violence in film. And somehow we remained tainted with that. Now, he's talking about one kind of violence. Pauline Kael is talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Pauline Kael's kind of violence that I'm really responding to with as feeling it accuracy and complementary, because there's gratuitous mindless violence, and then there is the depiction of how it really is, and I think that we depicted that by not doing it in an ordinary reportorial style. God knows we've been imitated thousands and thousands of times now by television shows. Every time you see kind of somebody attempting violence, they go into that basic slow motion. Well, in American films, at least, we did it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about Kael here. Let me quote her again. She says that You put the sting back in death.
Well, as I say, in a context of the times, where we were seeing it on the 6 o'clock news all over the country, bodies, helicopters crashing, people being killed, young men being rushed to the ambulances, there was a kind of desensitization in the nation to violence. And it seemed to us, to me, that it was important to depict it as it really is.
You fought in World War II.
Yes.
Were there images that stayed with you that influenced the way you've handled violence in your films?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little?
Well, they just simply were images. They were images mostly during the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them, and they were terrifying.
Were you injured yourself?
No. I was very fortunate. I wasn't really engaged in much action at all. But what little bit of action I saw was more action than I ever want to see again.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. As this controversy got stirred up about Bonnie and Clyde, you were back on Broadway directing the musical How Now, Dow Jones. I find that very amusing.
No, was I doing that?
I think so.
I think
yeah.
I was doing... I was doing Golden Boy with Sammy Davis.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, even so, quite a contrast.
Yeah, but my life has been filled with that kind of wonderful contrast of being able to work in the theater and in film.
Well, let's take a short break and then
All
we'll
right.
talk some more.
Splendid.
My guest is film director Arthur Penn. His new movie is Penn and Teller Get Killed. He also directed The Left-Handed Gun, The Miracle Worker, Bonnie and Clyde, Alice's Restaurant, Little Big Man, Night Moves, Four Friends, and, of course, the new film Penn and Teller Get Killed. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director Arthur Penn is my guest. Can we go back to 1958, to your first film, The Left-Handed Gun, which
Please.
Starred Paul Newman? And this was a psychological interpretation of the Billy the Kid story. How did you feel about making your movie debut in a Western that was going to be a new type of take on the genre?
Well, I felt rather exalted. First of all, the opportunity to make a film was mm-hmm. a pretty heady opportunity. And then, of course, to be... together with old friends, Fred Coe, who was the producer of it, Paul Newman, with whom I'd worked previously in television, and to be able to do a nice, modest little Western that had a quite different slant to it than conventional Westerns had had up to that point.
Did you feel that you and Newman took risks with his performance?
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, what kind of risks? What were you
well,
doing
Well, we went from the sort of basic, tight-jawed, laconic Western hero who said yup and up to somebody who was engaged in other kinds of interpersonal relationships, and they were visible in that film, and I think that was what sort of rather startled the American critics, although it quite fortunately for me delighted the European critics, most particularly André Bazin.
There's a shot I have to ask you about. There's a scene where Paul Newman and a woman who's married to one of his friends kiss. And that scene kind of dissolves or cuts into a flame, a fire. And I was wondering, you know, whenever you see scenes like that in the movie, you wonder if it's like a literal interpretation of, yes, and then they had sex and we're not going to show it. Here's the heat of the flame. Do you know what I mean?
I'm afraid that you're quite accurate about that. You know, this was early filmmaking.
Right.
For me, and every once in a while, I got a little too romantic and too poetic, and it was more than a little embarrassing.
You feel embarrassed about that shot now?
Well, it's evidence of somebody who was just finding out what the medium could do. I was very intoxicated by the medium of film, having come out of live TV where we didn't have the opportunity to edit and prepare scenes and so forth, and then to be able to make a film.
Right. Well, sure, you worked on Philco Playhouse and Playhouse 90.
That's right.
Had you studied the method?
Sure. You mean the acting method?
Right, exactly.
Oh, yes. I've been associated with the Actors Studio for 25 years.
Could you put into words how you've applied that as a director? I realize that might be too hard or too broad.
Well, in the shortest possible answer, I think it was an attempt to break stereotypes. And that's really what it was to get into some of the interior life of the characters. And that's what really we attempted to do in Left-Handed Gun, which was to take a Western and strip it of its kind of prototypical behavior and begin to get it down to direct, recognizable interpersonal behavior.
Well, you directed both the stage and screen version of The Miracle Worker. Did you have to rethink your presentation when you moved it from stage to screen?
Yes, I did, but I wish I'd done it more so. I wish I'd done more of understanding how the cinema could do certain things for us that instead we sort of articulated in language and that wasn't necessary.
What, for instance, would you have done differently now?
Oh, well, there are certain things in The Miracle Worker on the stage where we needed to have a voice of sort of opposition in order to have an obstacle, which is really what makes for a certain kind of conflict. And in that case, it was Captain Keller, Helen Keller's father, who was resigned to her terrible fate as a child who had no hearing and no sight. And Annie Sullivan, who, of course, insisted that the child could be in some way reached or hoped that she could. Well, on stage, it was necessary to give all that language and to have scenes that did it. When we put it on film, however, I wish I'd been aware that the camera could very well have provided us with a much more eloquent version of the enormity of Annie's problem, and we wouldn't have had to quite articulate it so melodramatically as we did in the play. Mm-hmm. But that was because it was only my second film, and I didn't know what I was doing quite.
I watched that film about a year ago and was really surprised at how moody and atmospheric it looked. I had forgotten that.
Yes, well, we all have a nostalgia for black and white films, and they're really remarkable in terms of being able to evoke mood.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we all were doing many more of them.
Well, you'd like to work more in black and white?
I'm always attracted by that, yes, as a medium. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes I go and I feel as if the screens are just so brilliantly colored you could practically get blood sugar from it.
Hmm. Do you have actors improvise much on the set?
No, not really. Not really. This is such an elaborate subject, but improvisation as it's practiced on a lot of movie sets is not really improvisation. It's actors writing lines on the spur of the moment. And that doesn't thrill me. Now, there are certain people who can do it, and every once in a while, they come up with some wonderful stuff. Brando does it, and does it wonderfully. But for the most part, I prefer not to really improvise. On the other hand, I don't really start addressing the language of the script right off the bat, either. It's just a way of sort of arriving at a scene in a much less formal manner until we're really ready to shoot. And at that point, I pretty much insist upon having the language of the script.
Mm-hmm. My guest is film director Arthur Penn, and his new film is Penn and Teller Get Killed. Your brother Irving was a acclaimed fashion photographer whose work was shown in many museums.
Is
shown in many museums, yes. And I'm wondering if there was something in your background when you were growing up together that you think led you both to such visual directions.
Well, I would like to be able to point my finger directly at it, but it doesn't really exist. We didn't spend an awful lot of time together when we were growing up. We were just two children in a family where there was divorce at an early age, and I went off in another direction, living with other people during my childhood until I was returned to Philadelphia at the time of last year of junior high school. And that's when I sort of rejoined my brother and we spent several years together at that point.
Oh, he's older than you are?
Yes, he is.
Did he influence you in any way, help you out, give you any guidance when you started working as a director? I figure he was established a few years before you were in his profession.
Well, he didn't give me guidance as a director, but he gave me guidance as a person. He's enormously important in my life, and we're very close friends.
Mm. Do you remember the first movie you ever saw?
No, I don't, because it traumatized me. I went to see a horror film with my brother, and I ended up crouching down under the seat. I remember that. It was in some theater on the east side of New York. And I didn't then go back to films for years.
Because you were so afraid from this movie?
Yes.
Does your brother remember what the movie was?
No, we... no, we were both very young. I mean, I must have been 5, and he was probably 10 at that point.
So when was the next time you went back?
Well, it wasn't until I was an adolescent in Philadelphia, and I began to then be able to go to films with some pleasure. And then finally, when I saw Citizen Kane, that was really the turning point in terms of gratification from film.
Well, looking back now as an adult and as a film director, what does it say to you that this movie, whatever the movie was, had such an impact on you that you were terrified and wouldn't even go back into the theater? I mean, what does it say about the power of movies to you? And
Well, there's no doubt about the power of movies. It's what in certain circles they call a counterphobic reaction, I guess, which is you get frightened by something and finally you decide, instead of staying frightened by it, you join it. And that seems to have been what turned out to be the case in my life. But I had never anticipated it. I never anticipated being in film. I always was drawn toward the theater as an adolescent.
Would you like to scare children with your movies?
I certainly wouldn't.
Okay.
I think the films that we're seeing nowadays are much too scary. I think they're terrible, actually. I think that the degree of violence in them and the basic simple-mindedness of the plotting seems to me to be appalling. Practically every other film is about some renegade cops who have to go out and get these big bad guys. But it's sort of simple-minded. I could wish at least for the Western to come back. It was a nice morality tale, you know. These are not even moral films, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. So really, it's the artfulness and morality of the violence that
attracts me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's something eloquent to be said about that. Not necessarily always involving violence. I have a nostalgia for films like The Miracle Worker, you know. I would like once in sometime in the foreseeable future to go to the theater, film theater, and see something which was genuinely enlightening. Even a very good love story. There are far too few of those. We got all those macho executives out there doing macho films, and I think maybe we need some more feminine touches in the choices of material.
You're working on an off-Broadway show right now. Do you have any other movies in the works?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us something about it? Or is it too soon?
It's really too soon, yeah. there's a film I'm I'm preparing for Pathé at the moment, which is a new company.
I wish you the best with that and with your new film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Director Arthur Penn has been my guest. His new movie is called Penn and Teller Get Killed, and it's opened in several cities, New York, Boston, Toronto, and San Francisco, and is scheduled to open in other cities probably in October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jean-Paul Sartre based the characters in one of his novels on John Jurassic's parents. Simone de Beauvoir wrote of the Jurassic family in one of her memoirs. Coming up, John Jurassic tells about writing the authorized biography of Jean-Paul Sartre. Also, jazz composer and pianist Kenny Barron pays homage to Thelonious Monk. And the book that's in every college dorm room is now out on home video. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg reviews the new version, the video version, of The Elements of Style. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A Beverly Hills jury today found Zsa Zsa Gabor guilty of slapping a policeman driving with an invalid license and having an open container of alcohol in her car. The jury, however, acquitted her of the charge of disobeying a police officer. The charges stem from Gabor's encounter with Officer Paul Kramer after he stopped her in June for driving her Rolls-Royce with out-of-date license plates. The charges carry a maximum penalty of 18 months in prison and a $3,400 fine. Federal prosecutors today announced 5 indictments against skinhead members in what's being called the most sweeping federal action against that racist anti-Semitic group. NPR's John Burnett reports.
5 members of the Confederate Hammerskins, a violent neo-Nazi skinhead gang based in Dallas, were indicted on civil rights and weapons violations. The charges stem from 2 separate incidents in Dallas last year. In one, skinheads painted swastikas and shot out windows at a Jewish synagogue and an Islamic mosque. In the other, a group of skinheads chased blacks and Hispanics from Robert E. Lee Park in Dallas, believing the park to be a symbol of white supremacy. The 8-month investigation has now charged a total of 16 skinheads in the Dallas area. A federal prosecutor told reporters today, racial hate crimes are crimes against the very idea of American freedom and democracy, and the Justice Department has no higher law enforcement priority. The grand jury will continue to hear more evidence as the federal assault on skinheads in Dallas progresses. This is John Burnett reporting.
Another record has been set for a major drug seizure. Officials in Los Angeles say today's confiscation of 20 tons of cocaine, valued at $2 billion, is the biggest such haul on record. The last major haul was just 7,200 pounds taken in Tampa, Florida last year. Police say today's cocaine was seized at a warehouse about 25 miles from downtown Los Angeles. Colombia's President Bergoglio Barco addressed the United Nations General Assembly today and called on member nations to join forces in a new world war against drugs. Melody Walker reports from the United Nations.
President Barco told the Assembly that illegal drugs are a global problem. He said concerted international action is necessary to defeat the scourge of narcotics. The Colombian president called for a special session of the General Assembly to address the drug problem and the establishment of an international working group of top government officials to coordinate anti-narcotics action. Barco also called for tighter controls on the manufacture and sale of chemicals used in the production of cocaine. He also called for restrictions on arms sales to drug traffickers and the outlawing of foreign mercenaries used to train what he called narco-terrorists. While Barco's speech focused on the drug problem, he also cited the need to aid Colombia's economy by approval of the International Coffee Agreement. For National Public Radio, this is Melody Walker at the United Nations.
Beer Baron August Busch Jr. died today. A spokesman for Anheuser-Busch in St. Louis says Busch died at the family's Grants Farm estate. He was 90 years old. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Kenny Barron is best known for his work with the quartet Sphere. Their last recording, Bird Songs, celebrated the music of Charlie Parker. But Sphere initially formed to perform the music of Thelonious Sphere Monk, to whom Barron pays tribute today.
If you could picture a graph with some lines, very sharp and jagged, peaks, hills and valleys, that would be, I think, a very good way of describing his playing. Very jagged and very angular. Monk was also himself influenced by, Duke Ellington for one, and he was also influenced by some of the early stride pianists like James B. Johnson. What I'd like to do now is to try and demonstrate that by playing one of Monk's pieces. This is a piece of his entitled Trinkle Tinkle. Thank you.
Kenny Barron plays on the latest recording by Sphere titled Bird Songs. This is Fresh Air. Jean-Paul Sartre was the godfather, or its atheist equivalent, to my guest John Gerassi. Gerassi's parents and Sartre were good friends in Paris before the Spanish Civil War. Now Gerassi has completed the first volume in his authorized biography of Sartre. Gerassi is a professor of political science at Queens College in New York and the author of The Great Fear in Latin America and The Premature Anti-Fascist. His biography of Sartre dates back to 1970, when Gerassi suggested to his publisher a book on Sartre. But the word was that Sartre wanted to write another volume of his autobiography and wasn't interested in cooperating with a biographer. But over lunch with Sartre in a Paris café, they discussed the possibility. Sartre wanted to know how Gerassi would write it and what would be the guiding principle.
Well, actually, I was kind of stuck for a while, and I thought about it, and then I said, well, I guess it would. I would try to explain why it took you 45 years to reach a position that took us five. You know, remember, this was during the Vietnam War, very militant times. And we, meaning American who opposed the war in Vietnam, had taken a general position of opposing imperialism all over the world. And we had gotten there relatively fast from the beginning of the Vietnam War to 1970, when I was talking to him. Where in his case, he had been aware of these things. He was the first philosopher to be aware that the only way that the rich stay rich and get richer, meaning the first and second world, was because the third world kept getting poorer and poorer. He was a third worldist long before anybody else. Anyway, so I said I would try to explain why it took him 45 years to reach a position that took us five. And he said, not bad, not bad, pas mal, you know, meaning it was clear he was expecting something else. So I was searched a little bit, and finally I said, well, I guess I would also try to explain how a revolutionary, because after all, you were a revolutionary, you have a revolutionary position, and can become a revolutionary without ever having rebelled against your state. In other words, without ever having stopped being a bourgeois, because you're through and through a bourgeois. And he liked that.
Do you think that that basic contradiction in his life, the fact that he was a bourgeois and a revolutionary, undermines any of his any of the stands that he took in his life?
No, not really. I mean, not for me. I think we're all contradictions, right? I mean, I look at myself. I have a lot of the same positions. I support the Third World against the United States, France, England, whatever it is, which exploits them. On the other hand, I live off that. I'm a tenured professor in Queens, and obviously my standard of living, to a great extent, is due to the fact that we exploit the Third World. So, and there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, how do I survive? I'm in that kind of bind exists for all of us. The only difference between, I would think, Sartre, myself, and some of my colleagues is that we're aware of the contradiction and we keep pointing it out, which doesn't get rid of the contradiction, but at least it means that we face it, whereas most of my colleagues don't. You know, they take it for granted that if they're not part of the administration in some way, then they haven't been co-opted by the kind of exploitation that goes on all over the world.
Well, in 1970, when Sartre decided that you should be his official biographer, you were going to set to work, but it was very hard to start. What was the problem, or what were the problems that you were up against?
Well, first place, we decided that we would do this mostly based on interviews. And I had from 71 till 75, during the academic year I was teaching in Paris, every other Friday, a two-hour interview with him. And I have these hundreds of hours of interviews. And some of them got very, very personal. And he would say things about Simone de Beauvoir, about his the other women in his life, about his relationship with some of the so-called friends that were being heralded around, or allies, and which in fact he didn't think were so honest or so committed, etc. He would say all these things, and then he would say, and I would say, well, I can't say that in the book. He said, well, look, use your judgment. I'm not going to tell you, don't say this, this is off record, or this, just use your judgment. And I was stuck, you know, I said, how do I not say this? This is very important stuff, and on the other hand, I don't want to say it as long as he was alive. And so that was one of the problems. And the other problem was that he kept saying to me, look, everything is political. There's no such thing as personal. So in a way, I thought that what he was trying to tell me was, put it in, it's all political. And then what happened was that, well, he died. And so that got me started. Once he died, I started, because he wasn't looking over my shoulder.
A couple of years ago, there was a biography of Sartre that came out, written by Annie Cohn-Solal. And you say that that biography liberated you.
Yeah. Since every sort of fact that was known is in the book, whether it's material, whether it's interesting, whether it's not interesting or not, it gave me this liberation. Suddenly, I didn't have to deal with all the trivia that, or all the facts that I thought were trivial. I could deal with the real meat, with the personalities, with the attentions, with the relationships that Sartre had. So I threw away everything I had written. That was actually 700 pages. But I didn't want to try to reconstruct it or change it. I just said, the whole tone is wrong. I threw it away, and I started again. And I wrote from a very personal point of view. Sartre was the most important man in my life, the man who had the most influence in my life. I had a very good relationship with him. I worked with him. We worked on the International War Crimes Tribunal. We had a political relationship, etc. He influenced me greatly, and politically, to a certain extent, I feel, with a touch perhaps here of immodesty to say this, but that I had some influence on him. And that's what I wanted to write about. You know, what kind of a man was he who could listen to a little, basically to a little, young punk? I mean, I was 50 years younger than he was. I mean, and yet he listened to me. He was interested in what I or anybody else had to say. And it seemed to me that was important to bring out.
Let's talk about how you knew Sartre. He was a friend of your parents. How did they know each other?
My father was a Spanish Sephardic, who born in Turkey, who ran away and went to Germany, met my mother in Germany. She was a Catholic from the Ukraine, which was then dominated by Austria, and had run away from a convent, and also in Germany. They met there. Eventually, they became lovers in France, where my mother was going to the Sorbonne. And at the Sorbonne, in her class, was Simone de Beauvoir. And they became very close friends. And my mother, who was a bit of a flirt and coquettish, taught Simone de Beauvoir how to dress and how to make her nails and how to flirt and how to pick up Hungarian, as Simone de Beauvoir says in her memoirs, how to pick up Hungarian students at the Bibliothèque Nationale, the National Library. Anyway, so they became very close. And she introduced, my mother introduced my father to be to Simone de Beauvoir, and they ended up having a fairly close relationship. And so Simone de Beauvoir introduced them to Sartre. Now, my father had studied philosophy in Germany and decided instead that he had been moved by a lecture by Wolfflin to become a painter, and was, in fact, in Paris already practicing as a painter. So that relationship was very solid, the four of them. They went on vacations together. They did all these things. But what attracted Sartre, he told me, to my father, was that my father was a very brutal writer. In other words, Sartre wanted to say about himself that first he wrote, destined to become a great literary figure. And he looked at my father, who said, first I paint. In fact, I myself remember once my father having a fight with my mother in the room next door and screaming finally at him and said, you don't understand. First I paint. I don't care if you starve. I don't care if Tito starves. That's my nickname, Tito. First I paint, then I take care of my family. And this is what Sartre admired. And then came 1936, Civil War in Spain. And my father immediately went to fight there. And this really perplexed Sartre. How can somebody who said, first I paint, therefore is not interested in or it's secondarily interested in the political events of the world, give it all up to go fight for a cause, no matter how pure, no matter how right?
Sartre was the first male adult outside of any of the hospital workers who saw you after you were born. So he was used to you as being the son of his two good friends. Was it hard for you when you became an adult to form an adult relationship with him?
No, because it was based on political activity. When I came back to France in 68, 69 rather, it was after having been jailed for my activity against the war in Vietnam, for having lost my job and being blacklisted. And he liked that. He liked the fact that I had been such a militant, and that's how we approached each other at the beginning as two individuals opposed to the war in Vietnam and opposed to the imperialist policies both of France and of the United States.
You've called your biography of Sartre Hated Conscience of His Century. In what way do you think of him as the hated conscience?
Well, he makes every intellectual feel ambiguous about his own life. Every intellectual that accepts honors, every intellectual that says, well, I really disapprove of what the government is doing on X, Y, and Z, but they've asked me to help them out on A, which I approve of, and so on. Sartre always, and Sartre's life as well as his works, end up being, in effect, a statement to those intellectuals saying, that's bad faith. Right? An intellectual must always be critical, must always be outside, must always of power, must always criticize power, because nobody else does. That's the role of the intellectual, by definition. So that while the kids loved him, and when he died, you know, there was a spontaneous march of 50,000 kids that marched with him with his ashes to the cemetery, the intellectuals of the world, with very few exceptions, always wanted to criticize him. In the Anglo-Saxon world, in the United States and in England, he was criticized during his livelihood, and his books were not read. But the intellectual in France had to respond to him, had to come to terms, because Sartre had access to the press and had his own newspaper and own magazines and so on. Once he died, they could dump on him. They could say he was an anachronism, he was passé, he was really a communist stool all along, or he was really whatever, right? The reason for that is because he's the conscience. His work, as well as his writing, but his work tells them, you guys sell out, and you sell out cheap. You're fascinated with power, and all you write or all you proclaim about your independence, you'll give up immediately if you're offered a position of power. And he was offered over and over again those positions, always turned them down.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Not at all. My pleasure.
John Jurassic is the author of Jean-Paul Sartre, Hated Conscience of His Century, Volume 1, published by the University of Chicago Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, in California, federal authorities and local police made what was apparently the largest cocaine seizure ever. How are you following the story?
We'll have a report from California. 20 tons of cocaine, Terry. It seems like an extraordinary amount. And we'll ask how so much of the stuff could be gathered together in one place. We'll also be covering the president's trip to South Carolina to visit the disaster areas left by Hurricane Hugo. And we're going to have a piece on the barrier islands. Many people built houses on those barrier islands, and they were knocked down by the hurricane. The Coastal Commission may not let those people put their houses back.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the years, many writers, aspiring writers, and students have used a reference book called The Elements of Style to check when to use a which or a that and where to properly place a comma. Now The Elements of Style is on video. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on this transformation of the text.
I have a lot of sympathy for people who try to bring literary classics to the screen. However faithful they are to the text, the critics always complain that the spirit of the original is lost. In the last couple of years, that's been the fate of A Room with a View, Little Dorrit, and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. So maybe it's just as well that the critics haven't picked up on still another recent adaptation of a classic, the video version of Strunken White's The Elements of Style. The Elements of Style is a 92-page collection of pithy maxims about style and usage. To deliver The Elements of Style to the electronic age, the video producers selected CBS correspondent Charles Osgood. He sits in front of an old-fashioned roll-top desk and a shelf of leather-bound books. He wears the kind of jaunty red bow tie favored by media stars who have built their careers on lovable cantankerousness, like George Will and Andy Rooney. Osgood is not a bad choice. If The Elements of Style were a person, it would wear a red bow tie, too. The faithfulness of the adaptation is unassailable. The entire video consists of Osgood reading the book aloud, word for word.
Avoid the use of qualifiers, rather, very, little, pretty. These are the leeches that infest the pond of prose, sucking the blood of words. The constant use of the adjective little, except to indicate size, is particularly debilitating. You should all try to do a little better and should be very watchful on this rule, for it is a rather important one, and we are pretty sure to violate it now and then.
The producers claim that the video makes The Elements of Style come alive in a way that just reading it can't. Still, I'm not sure what lessons someone would learn from actually listening to the book. The value of The Elements of Style comes not so much from the actual advice it gives, which is a mixture of the commonplace and the out-and-out cranky, as from its admirably terse and direct way of putting things. But the language of the book was never meant to be spoken by any human voice. Osgood does a bravura job, but sentences that strike you as models of conciseness when you're reading the book to yourself come off as pretty dense when they're read aloud.
Two-part sentences of which the second member is introduced by as, in the sense of because, for, or, nor, or while, in the sense of at the same time, likewise require a comma before the conjunction. However, if a dependent clause or an introductory phrase requiring to be set off by a comma precedes the second independent clause, no comma is needed after the conjunction.
Sometimes the effect is comical, as when Osgood reads the book's discussion of the modern spelling of thruway as thruway and tries valiantly to find a pronunciation difference between two spellings of the same word.
In combination with way, through is more serviceable than through. It is a high-speed word for readers who are going 60. It is conceivable that because of our throughways, through will eventually become through after many more thousands of miles of travel.
Strange that a text that sounds so natural when you hear it read silently should sound so forced when you hear it read aloud. It shows how much artifice there is in good writing, especially writing that aims for a natural, plain-spoken tone. That's the point of The Elements of Style, of course, and in a backhand way, the video proves it rather nicely.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Well, we end today's program with goodbyes and thanks to Ed Dougherty. He joined Fresh Air nearly 3 years ago. You've heard on the air the results of his top-notch production work, but only if you've worked with him in the trenches would you be aware of his awesome ability to simultaneously play air guitar with the Grateful Dead, talk back to the action news anchors, read the sports pages, send a message on the wire, while editing tape under deadline and debating politics with Chris and Naomi. Ed has an intuitive sense of radio, a passion for ideas, and a tireless sense of mission. And although we're miserable that Fresh Air will no longer be the beneficiaries of his many talents, we're looking forward to hearing the new program he's been hired to produce in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, intrepid misadventurer Tim Cahill tells us about the proper footwear for walking across the Death Valley Desert and how to behave when you're surrounded by man-eating sharks. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the soundtrack from a new documentary about Thelonious Monk. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.